As we close out 2013, we look back on the year in books and highlight some of our favorite reads. Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Melanie Lowers, books editor at the Cape Cod Times, joins us. Good morning.
Good morning, Mindy.
All right, Melanie, 2013, year of the reader.
Well, I think so. Over the last year, and I've been doing this for a long time, or long enough certainly to see trends come through. And what I noticed is where several years ago there was sort of a defensiveness about reading, bookstores closing and people don't have time and they're only interested in electronic devices. And I'll get to that in a minute. And that kind of thing. What I saw this year was sort of a surge in stories about the increased popularity of books and reading and larger size gatherings at literary festivals, more books being read, more books being sold, both by big box and independent bookstores. And in fact, kind of a surge in the stability of independent bookstores and new independent bookstores being opened. Mm-hmm. I've seen a number of stories this year from all over the country about, of course, they run out and interview the person who's opening an independent bookstore because in the sort of the conventional thinking, why would you do that? But in fact, people are opening them all over the place. And I think it kind of started with Ann Patchett, mm-hmm. the novelist who opened an independent bookstore in Nashville because there wasn't one. And she said, if nobody's going to open one, I am. And that became a national story. So I think others have followed suit where they've seen a need. And I've had conversations with people who in various places saying, well, we don't have any bookstores where I am. And I'll go, well, I've got, like 20
okay, we're lucky.
Independent bookstores. But in a lot of locations in the country, there aren't any. You really have to drive to get to one.
So we should be thankful for our independent bookstores.
Oh, we should definitely be thankful for those because it sets us apart in that way. But I do think that this year has shown a real turnaround and the publishers made money. Mm-hmm. And that, underlying all is also what it's all about.
I'm curious, Jill, what you've seen in the library. I mean, when we had that downturn in the economy, of course, people couldn't afford books, so they ended up going to the library. What did you see this last year?
Well, I would say we also certainly every day see lots and lots of people who are still reading but are reading in all formats. So it's not just reading necessarily the paper book. We certainly are circulating increasing numbers of e-books. We prepare for January because we know that there will be so many gifts of e-readers at Christmas. So we know that the week after Christmas, we will be spending lots of time explaining to people how to download books from OverDrive. And I think that one of the things that is happening is that a lot of people are really understanding what the value of an independent bookstore or a library can be, and that they're really excited about going back to those places. The key is, of course, to make sure that when you go into your independent bookstore, you don't then rush home and order it from some big retailer. No names need to be mentioned. That you actually do support your local booksellers because that's how they stay in business. And I'm always delighted to see 20-somethings in town who have not been in the library for a really long time, and they come back. And I actually just this week had somebody who came in and she said, I was wondering where to get this. And I was going to go to, here or there. And then she said, I could get it at the library. And I was like, yes, thank you so much for choosing your library. Yeah. So I think that people are really, again, we are packed to the gills. And I think it's a really good thing. Yeah. And the people are certainly reading. And people read all the time in that even if they're not reading a book, I think that people spend so much time online. A lot of that is in fact reading blogs, reading everything, articles.
Well, that's a good point
because
in
magazines.
Facebook, I find myself able to access long reads, what we now call long reads, in places that I don't have subscriptions to or don't have access to. And I find that, really helpful too. The dialogue, the general dialogue out there is based on reading. And I think a lot of it is based on books.
Yeah. And you have a confession.
I do have a confession. I'm coming out of the book closet here. My husband, shockingly, gave me a Nook last year for Christmas, and I was stunned. I never asked for one. It never crossed my mind that I would want one because I've spent decades in paper, happily in paper. But I found in the last year that I became, I don't know if it's possible to become a more voracious reader, But I am as voracious a reader as I've ever been. And I go back and forth between paper. If something comes to me in paper, I read paper. If it doesn't and I hear about it and I'm home at night, I use my Nook. Mm-hmm. And I love it. And I take it everywhere with me. And I do a lot of crosswords, too. So you know, I'm trying to do that part of it. But in order to do the show today, the Nook did not work for this. So I couldn't go back and do the year in review, you know, in the same way with the Nook. But a lot of the things that I'm going to talk about today, I read on the Nook. And it was a wonderful experience. So right. I'm not going to say, you know.
Right. Well, and I think this whole idea of the physical book is really versus the e-book is a really interesting one. And one of the books actually I brought today is, in fact, a book that is sort of the anti-Nook book.
Yes.
as in it is an artifact in and of itself. And they very clearly, the designers of this book, very consciously wanted you to buy this as a object, mm-hmm. not as an ebook.
What is it?
Called S, and it's actually was dreamed up by J.J. Abrams, who is the guy that did Lost and many TV series, written by a guy named Doug Dorst. But I just fell in love with this book because, in fact, it is designed as if it were a library book. So it comes with a Dewey number on its spine with an actual, you know, sticker. It comes inside of it. If you open up, it says book for loan. There are stamps in it. It says keep this book clean on the back. And it has a return date and it shows you all the times the book has been checked out. But even more remarkable about this book is it contains all this ephemera within the pages, just as a real object that is a book might. And in the margins of this novel, there is a basic novel, but there are like more than one novels in this book because you have the people who are commenting on the novel in the margins. So you have handwriting of two people who are having a conversation about the book in the margins of the book. It's a fabulously designed item.
Yeah.
It is brilliant. Yeah. And it is part of that. We don't want to lose the book as an object. We don't want to have it only be this digital version. There are postcards, there's maps, there's notes, there's a decoder.
That'd be tough to read in a Nook, wouldn't it?
You could do it because it would not be the same experience.
Yeah.
And I think it's really exciting that they're doing this. In one of the reviews of this, it talks about how there are almost 24 trinkets inserted between the book's pages, including postcards, letters, and a map drawn in ink on a paper napkin. And there's a navigational wheel that's also a decoder. May I also say that this novel has brought a great deal of ire from librarians who are trying to catalog the thing and trying to circulate it with all the pieces is not an easy
not
task.
Easy, yeah.
But I think it is such an homage to the library book and the printed book that I love it. I'm just delighted with it.
Sounds like it would make a great gift.
Yeah. All right, let's start with history. What have you got for history, Melanie?
Okay, I read a lot of history and I've talked about it here on the show quite a bit. But the book that stands out for me this year is a book called Year Zero, A History of 1945. And I've read widely in the both world wars, but I had never really seen a book that talked about the aftermath. We know somewhat of the aftermath in Japan, and we know somewhat of the aftermath in Germany. But when you think about it, this was a world war, and all over Asia, all over the Middle East, all over North Africa, all over Europe, and some fairly kind of out of the way places, war went on. And so what Ian Buruma does, and he's a wonderful historian, a world historian, who talks about fiction and fiction when he works on these books, and he's currently in residence at Bard College. What he does is he takes the story of his father in the Netherlands, who was taken to Germany and ended up working in a factory as slave labor through the whole war, and eventually made his way back to the Netherlands, and then they moved again, because everyone was sort of rootless. I think this was sort of the beginning of enormous changes of location and mobility of an entire entire populations from one place to another. They had either been moved there by war, or they couldn't go back, or they moved on because of bad memories or whatever, but just a huge upheaval worldwide. And so he goes from place to place talking about this astonishing year. Of course, we know that the war in Germany was over in May, and the war with Japan was over in August. And other than that, we've got this incredible sort of upheaval. And so he goes nation to nation, and he also goes into places like, you know, he starts with the exaltation of the end of the war. And we have pictures of that. Mm. We have some sense of it from, you know, the pictures that we've seen of people dancing in streets and celebrating and that kind of thing. But we have to think about people who are exulting in small places too, that it was over. This long, terrible bit of history was over. And he goes into what he calls liberation complex, exaltation, hunger, and revenge. Then we have the clearing of the rubble. There's destruction everywhere. So how do you start? And I've thought about that many times. You know, you see a World War II movie and you go, who came next? You know, the people with the shovels or what? And he talks about that, people who have to be repatriated and that kind of thing. And then this sort of sense by the end of 1946 that things need to be put into place so this never happens again. Mm. And we know that we have a number of institutions, even new nations, new names, new laws that are meant to do that. And he says, the story of my father, as I said, not as bad as many others, but bad enough, was what made me curious about what happened just after the most devastating war in human history. How did the world emerge from the wreckage? What happens when millions are starving or bent on bloody revenge? How are societies, or civilization, a popular word at the time, put together again? And I found that I was just as equally fascinated with it. It is a page turner. Mm, he's a wonderful writer.
I love a history that's a page turner.
And I would highly recommend it.
What have you got, Jill?
I've brought along a book that was actually self-published, as it were, but one of the most beautiful self-published books I've ever seen. It is called The Glorious Good Times, The First 100 Years of the Quissett Yacht Club, which is a yacht club in Falmouth, the neighborhood in Falmouth, edited by Prosser Gifford, Nina Hocker, and Stephen Chalmers, and published by the Quissett Yacht Club. So you'd think, you know, how exciting this is going to be. But it is so beautifully done. Mm-hmm. The layout is gorgeous. The photographs
they have included are
just stunning. And it's not, while it is about this one particular piece of the town, it goes much larger than that, because it's talking about things that happen in the United States, in the world, that affect that one little spot in the world. And so even if you have no interest in sailing whatsoever, mm-hmm. it's still this beautiful historic story of what has happened in this one little place in the world. And they have some great little tidbits in here. Not only great photographs, and the photographs are how they found all this, I don't know, but great things that are in here. But there's this little piece that's about a remembrance. They've interviewed people, a remembrance of somebody who'd been at one of these dinner parties, and it gives you an idea of the flavor of this book. The Websters always had dinner parties on Sunday noon, a large assemblage, especially in the summer. Lunch was always very firmly at 1, no questions asked. And before lunch, at 12:30, there was always served what was known as the summer cocktail, which was approximately 50% pineapple juice and 50% gin. The cocktails were served up by Andrew the butler, who always sampled them very liberally before he came out.
You had to make sure it tastes good, right?
Promptly at 1, you went in for the customary roast beef with Yorkshire pudding and then ice cream with chocolate sauce, or maybe strawberries if they were in season.
Wow, you need a nap after that lunch. Yeah. Yeah,
but so evocative of the times.
Oh, so much so. All right, I've got two quick ones here. Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution, of course, Nathaniel Philbrook. You know, he always amazes me, you know, obviously writes a lot about history, but this is, you know, Boston, 1775, occupied by British troops after a series of incidents by patriots who range from sober citizens to thuggish vigilantes. You know, but what I love about him is he finds always new characters and new ways of looking at things. So you may think you know this history, but when you read this, you'll go, wow, I didn't know that. Or, you know, he, like I say, he brings in some new faces that you might not have heard of before. So that's one I would recommend. The other one that I really enjoyed this year was Defiant Brides, the untold story of two revolutionary era women and the radical men they married. And this is Nancy Rubin Stewart. And this is the story of two revolutionary era teenagers who defy their loyalist families to marry radical patriots, Henry Knox and Benedict Arnold. And one becomes a patriot, the other a spy. And this is another fascinating look at history through a different lens than what you normally might read. And I think both of those were fabulous. Anybody got anything else in history? All right. What do we got next? Nonfiction.
Well, last year, 2012, I read mostly nonfiction. This year I didn't. But what I did read was very good and very informative, and I kind of caught up on some things. And at the very top of my list, and I believe it will always be at the top of my list, I don't know what's going to knock it off, is Andrew Solomon's Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. It is so gorgeous. It is so meaningful. It is so full of human effort and humanity. And it has won prize after prize after prize. It's the winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award. It's the winner of the Dayton Literary Peace Prize for nonfiction. It's the winner of a Books for a Better Life Award. I don't know if you've ever heard of that.
No,
but
I
often find now, I don't know when this award came into being, but I'm often finding that the books I really feel very, you know, impacted by end up having won the Books for a Better Life Award.
You got to get their list. Yeah.
Now I'm looking for them. And it was also the winner for those of you out here who have some kind of relationship with NAMI, the National Association for on Mental Illness. It is the winner of the 2013 NAMI of New York City Seeds of Hope Award. So this tells you that it has enormous credentials, and he does anyway. Mm-hmm. He's everywhere and doing everything. And he opens up this beautiful and very large book with a part of a poem by Wallace Stevens. The imperfect is our paradise. Note that in this bitterness, delight, since the imperfect is so hot in us, lies in flawed words and stubborn sounds. And then this book is just a beautiful discussion of parents who have had children who are not like them. And it might be parents, hearing parents who have a child who is deaf, or seeing parents who have a child who is blind, or parents who have a child who has cerebral palsy, mm-hmm. or a strong or intrusive ADD or autism, or you name it. Even parents who have a child who ends up committing a horrific crime. A child with a different moral center. So the book is very large. He takes all the possible time he needs in order to explain this. There will never, I believe, be another book like this, because I think that Andrew Solomon did this already. And if you are a parent of a child who's different than yourself, or if you know someone who is, I would heartily recommend that you send them this to this book. Show it to them. Mm-hmm. It's a life changer.
Right.
It really is.
We're talking about our favorite books of 2013. We'll get more nonfiction after a quick break.